The next case is 0954, Timothy Mines versus Otis Brooks et al.
I think we're still good morning. Good morning, good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm Scott Brom, and I represent the appellants JDG Home Inspections and Tim Gamble. I'd respectfully reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We're here once again, as the court just recently addressed in the case of Sullivan versus Anderson Township, to, in the court's words, answer the often asked question of whether an order is a final and appealable order. In the current case, we have a certified conflict involving the interrelation between Revised Code Section 2711-02C, which deals with the granting or denial of a motion to stay a case pending arbitration, and Civil Rule 54B. There are two courts of appeals, plus the one in this case, that held that a 2711-02C order was not appealable in a multi-claim, multi-party case without 54B language. There were two courts of appeals that said the statute was sufficient, that language wasn't necessary.
Is there anything legally different? I know the parties involved are different in that that was a township. Is there any legal principle that's different from our recent decision of Sullivan?
Absolutely not. And in fact, I can be very brief. The Sullivan analysis and the brief, Sullivan was released during briefing in our case.
Right.
The parties, my opening brief, laid out a whole number of issues that dealt with the interrelationship between Revised Code 250502 and 54B and substantive law versus procedural law, et cetera. Then Sullivan was released. And basically what Sullivan said was the two-step process where you look at the statute and 54B language, that's the ordinary case. And in the ordinary case, you have to go through the two-step process. But where the legislature has specifically declared that an order is final and appealable, you don't do the two-step process because there's no reason to go to Rule 54B. The trial court has no discretion at all to address the issue, and the order is by definition final appealable. So the answer to your question is no, the legal analysis. If the court were to apply the legal analysis in Sullivan to Revised Code 2711-02C and the facts in the current case, we believe the result would be that 54B language is not necessary.
I'll obviously ask opposing counsel the same question, but is there any reason we simply can't reverse this on the authority of Sullivan?
Not in my opinion, Your Honor. Absolutely. And frankly, that the issue truly is that simple. This isn't the ordinary case. The legislature has declared the order at issue final appealable, even without 54B language, and the Court of Appeals erred by refusing to take up the case on jurisdictional grounds. And we'd request that it be reversed and remanded for consideration on the merits.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. At issue in this case is whether or not, as counsel has indicated, final appealable a ruling under 2711-02C granting a motion to stay claims or denying a motion to stay claims pending arbitration is a final appealable order when there are multiple parties or claims at issue in the case and there is a lacking of 54B language. In response specifically to Justice Stratton's question with respect to whether or not there are any legal differences between the Sullivan case and the instant case, I would submit that there are two primary legal differences. The first, in looking at the statute specifically in 2711-02 is compared to the immunity statute, which is 2744. 2711-02 refers to an action, quote-unquote an action that is stayed or denied pending arbitration. And I would submit that this court 20 years ago in the Noble case looked at what the definition of an action was in reviewing the federal civil rule 54B and determined that an action constituted both a claim and a counterclaim. I would submit that in accordance with this court's finding in Noble, that there is a two-step process, the first step being determining that there is a final order under 2505, and then secondly determining whether or not there are multiple claims that exist, that the court or the legislature, in including the words in action in 2711, the court in essence was saying that that satisfied the first prong of the test. It became a final order in the context of a 2505 order. However, by saying that it implies in essence the entire action, by including the words in action, it left open the issue of whether or not it was a final order for purposes of 54B because there are multiple parties. Moving secondly to the policy considerations beyond the legal considerations, there are numerous issues. First, the Sullivan case dealt with an immunity issue. There is ample public policy that this court, or there should not be 54B language in multiple parties and multiple claims in an immunity issue, because in essence, when that determination is made, and if immunity is found to exist, the case is over for that party, and there's no need for them to participate in the trial, and so it would be not a just result if the court were to require that the municipality or the government entity to participate in a trial and then appeal it on the back end. In this instance, you've got an issue where an arbitration clause is at issue, and the record is clear that there was a finding by the trial court that the arbitration clause was unconscionable. It includes a limitation on liability, and in fact, the individuals, the consumers, would have to pay more to arbitrate the case than they could ever recover under the express terms of the arbitration clause. So we respectfully submit that it's different than an immunity case in the instance that the consumer, the trial judge, makes a determination that there is an unconscionable arbitration clause, that the case would never be arbitrated because of the unconscionability, and so consequently, it is better in the trial judge's discretion to submit this case to trial and then allow the issue of whether or not arbitration should have been granted to be ferreted out on appeal. And that is consistent with this court's general analysis in General Electric Supply Company, where the court went through a number of policy considerations about whether or not it is important for there to be whether or not arbitration would be a final appeal, a ruling on arbitration would be a final appealable order. And this court talked about a number of things, delay tactics, whether or not the merit in keeping everything in a single appeal, the fact that the individual claiming a right to arbitrate has not lost their right to arbitrate, and in fact they could very well win at trial, and then there would be no need to use the court's discretion on whether or not they should have been entitled to arbitration to begin with. If this court were to apply Sullivan in the instance of arbitrations, and in essence is giving free rein to every company to include in every consumer contract and otherwise arbitration provisions, and they get an automatic quick jump to the Court of Appeals, whether or not that's denied, whether or not it's upheld, and the trial court is divested of all jurisdiction to determine whether or not exists substantive unconscionability, procedural unconscionability in these arbitration contracts, and we respectfully submit that short circuits the ability of individuals in regular cases to have their claims heard, and then of course have these matters determined on appeal.
What kind of, we were to write that in an opinion supporting your view, how would we present that? I mean, is that a constitutional argument? It isn't, I don't think. It's a policy argument that we think that the General Assembly is amiss here because it has created a process that does what you say it would do?
Mr. Justice, I think that the way you frame it is that there for policy considerations is a difference between Sullivan and immunity cases and cases where a arbitration clause it is issue. Because in the case of an arbitration, there will always be a trial. It's just a question of whether the trial is in court or whether the trial is in arbitration. In an immunity instance, if there is a granting of immunity, there's no trial. So in answer to your question, I think first and foremost, if this court wants to look directly at the statute, the court can distinguish this statute from the statute at play in the immunity, because it says two things. First, it defines an action, which is more than one. Can be comprised of more than one claim. So the statute is in essence saying that when an entire action is stayed, then pursuant to 2505, it is a final order. In this instance, you don't have the stay of an entire action. You have a stay of a portion of an action. And I will tell the court, in essence, what happens, which is what's happened in this case, is that trial proceeded on a portion of the case. The case ended up bifurcated. There was a jury trial on a portion of the case. This portion of the case went up on appeal. The appellant has never answered the lawsuit. Theoretically, what you have happening is that then it goes back for a second trial. If this ultimately ends up before the trial court, you go back for a second trial, and then you have series of appeals that are stemming therefrom. And so it's more efficient, as this court's indicated in General Electric Supply, to have all of these appellate issues addressed at one time. Whether or not the arbitration should have been granted is certainly an appropriate issue for appeal, and it allows the trial, rather than having multiple trials and empty chairs and things of that nature, it allows the trial to proceed and have all of these issues addressed on appeal.
We can also look at the substantive argument that's made in the 2711, which talks about final orders, and 54B as the appealability of those orders in multi-party litigation, allowing the trial judge to make that determination under 54B as to when a portion then becomes appealable. Could we not?
Yes, and that's exactly appropriate with what this court held in Noble. It gives the trial judge the discretion. The trial judge is most apt to know the parties, know the evidence of the case, know the issues in the case, and it gives the trial judge the opportunity to evaluate whether or not the arbitration clause at issue is unconscionable, whether or not it's substantively or procedurally unconscionable, and then make a determination of whether or not claims are going to be stayed pending arbitration. Exclusively in this instance, the record will show that the trial judge was asked by appellant to enter a nunc pro tunc, giving 54B language in the order, and the trial judge denied that. The trial judge made a determination that the arbitration clause was unconscionable, and this issue was appropriate for appeal after the trial. Instead, what we have now is a bifurcated trial, bifurcated set of appeals. It's difficult for all of the witnesses involved. It's expensive for all of the litigants involved. It's much more efficient and more of interest to justice.
Procedurally, the court granted the order to arbitrate initially, did it not?
There was an agreed order initially to arbitrate. And then
for whatever reason, it wasn't clear to me, the court vacated that order.
Appellees filed a 60B motion to vacate the order and a memorandum contra to the motion to stay claims pending arbitration based on the fact that the appellant refused to concede that the limitation on liability provision in the arbitration clause was unconscionable and unenforceable. And appellees did not want to go and proceed to arbitration, spending more than $3,500 to arbitrate what could amount to a $350 claim. And so sought relief from the court to set aside the agreed order to arbitrate and instead have appellants participate in the trial. And it's that order that's been appealed from.
In the immunity statute in Sullivan, the court, the legislature said that you have a right to an immediate appeal. But it was silent as to what happens in multi-party. So we had to determine whether that was precluded when you have multi-parties. The statute at issue here in C is the same sort of language. You have a right to immediate appeal. It is also silent as to what happens in multiple parties. So we had two almost identical statutes, with one with immunity and one with arbitration, where the language is silent as to multiple parties. And you wanna, are you saying that we interpret this one differently, even though the legislature uses the same language, based on what we think the public policy of the legislature was, or what the public policy we think should be? On what basis do we distinguish exact identical language saying you have an immediate right to appeal?
I think that the court can look at two things. With respect to the specific statutory language under Noble, the court, first off, under Noble, the court says, what is this a 2505 appealable order? And under Sullivan, the court said, because there's a statute that says it's a final appealable order, it's a 2505 appealable order, and we're not going to look to a 54B issue because the statute is silent. Here, the statute gives us a little bit more in which the court can distinguish from Sullivan. First and foremost, it says that the stay of a trial of any action, and an action implies or means more than one cause of action. So the
That exists in immunity cases. They often have multiple actions. And they have an immunity case, and then they have a reckless case, and a negligence case, and intentional tort case. So you have that same fact pattern. So that, to me, doesn't create the difference.
Specifically, if you were to look at the statute of play in the immunity statute, it talks about the granting of an order, and it doesn't talk about. And I appreciate that there are actions at issue, and multiple parties in actions, but the specific language that the General Assembly adopted in the immunity statute does not reference an action. Instead, it just says an order is a final order relating to granting or denying immunity is a final order. You contrast that with the statute at play here. It's talking about the stay of an entire action fulfills the 2505 component, but when
it,
you
again
end up
says an order that grants or denies a stay is a final order. It still references order. So again, your argument that one's an order and one's not an order?
Isn't the argument whether it's appealable as a final appealable order or a final order? I know that the dissent made that distinction. It was not made in the majority in Sullivan, but still, I mean, we are talking about 54B allowing for appealability of orders that are final, but it is within the purview of the trial court to make that determination. And in this way, we can give effect to both statutes and their language.
And I think what the majority, reasonably so, wrestling with in reconciling Sullivan with this case is the statutory language. And I think the additional language in 2711 affords this court a unique opportunity to, in essence, contrast this with general immunity cases by saying that 2711 deals with the first prong, which is a stay of an entire action, multiple claims, an entire action stayed, then it's a final order. You look when there are Sullivan, this statute, just like in Sullivan, doesn't address when there are multiple claims and multiple parties and one portion of it is stayed. And I think by saying that this statute is more specific to a full action being stayed, then this court can look to the second prong of the Noble test and determine whether or not there's 54B language. Above and beyond that, and understand, I certainly concede that Sullivan is difficult to deal with in my position, which is why I offer also what are real-life policy considerations and the differences between immunity statute, which would take the government agency completely out of the litigation altogether and would be a final result. And there is an injustice by forcing a government agency to participate in litigation and then argue it on appeal that they should have been granted immunity. That's different here. Here you're talking about every single arbitration clause at issue would automatically be not only, regardless of what the trial court rules, regardless of the trial court's discretion, it would automatically be appealed up, and you would have bifurcated trials. You would have more than one appeal on the front end and the back end, and we would submit from a policy perspective that's certainly not in the interest of justice to allow that to happen in arbitration cases, especially in an arbitration case where you've got a trial court finding that the underlying clause was unconscionable, and in the trial court's sound discretion, that issue was not going to be reversed on appeal, and so it was appropriate to be raised after a trial. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Rosen. Mr. Brom, you've saved most of your time, about 12 minutes. You're not compelled to use all of it. But
I don't think I will need
you
to.
You may if you wish.
Just a couple of brief points in rebuttal. First of all, the facts in Sullivan versus Anderson Township, that was not a complete grant of immunity in that case. There were multiple claims against the township where I believe it was two were granted immunity and two were denied immunity. So that did not resolve that case at all. It was going to proceed regardless of that issue. Secondly, this is not about the policy, and I can talk about the policy, but it's not about the policy. It's about the language of the statute. And the legislature has made a determination that arbitration orders, and this isn't just a stay. These 2711-02C doesn't apply to only stays. It applies to either the granting or the denial of an arbitration order. And that's an important point, because both parties have a very serious interest in getting that question answered promptly. There's an established public policy in Ohio in favor of arbitration. That's black letter law. Where that case is going to proceed, whether it's in court or in arbitration, is a critical issue. In arbitration, you have no jury, you have different rules, et cetera, et cetera. It's just as important for the plaintiff to be able to take that case up on appeal if the stay is granted, as it is for the defendant to be able to take that case up on appeal if the stay is denied. So that's an important distinction there.
Mr. Braun, can you also look at it that we have the substantive statute regarding the arbitration being a final order, and then you have the 54B procedural rule that a trial judge may determine based on the multiple claims and parties whether an action should go up on appeal, whether the final order should be appealed under 54B. How do you answer that?
Well, I answer it just based out of the language straight out of Sullivan. And counsel mentioned Noble several times. Noble is the normal, ordinary case. That's the two-step statute 54B analysis. The Sullivan opinion stated at paragraph 10, in this case, we need not apply the general rules for determining whether an action is final or whether an order is final and appealable. The general rules regarding final appealable orders in multi-party, multi-claim cases involve the tandem of 2505-02 for substance and 54B for procedure. It then goes on to state at paragraph 12, here, however, no such determination by the trial court is necessary. The General Assembly has expressly made that determination with the enactment of 2744, which was a statute at issue in that case. And I would submit it cannot be reconciled, the logic in Sullivan and the analysis in Sullivan, with this statute to come to any other conclusion. I think there's several distinctions between Sullivan and the current case, where if Sullivan had gone the other direction, I think I could distinguish it and still prevail, because I think we have a better set of facts and a better statute here. But on the way Sullivan came down, that analysis applied to 2711-02C answers that question. It's not necessary to consider 54B when the legislature's said what they already said. Real briefly, the whole issue of unconscionability, that is an issue that was not litigated, and I just want to clarify that for the record. It's not before this court. What happened in this case, the agreed arbitration order was entered. Plaintiffs elected down the road to file a 60B motion to vacate that order. That 60B motion didn't even address the unconscionability of the arbitration clause. It sought leave to file a brief on that point. And when the trial court vacated the 60B motion, it went a step further and sua sponte denied our motion to stay. That wasn't even before the trial court. What would have happened or should have happened had the 60B motion been granted was the plaintiffs could have filed their response, discovery, depositions, and an evidentiary hearing would have been held, and the trial court would have had the opportunity to issue a ruling on unconscionability, which is a legitimate challenge to an arbitration clause. So that entire issue has nothing to do with where we are right now, but on the record in this case, that was never litigated regardless.
Thank you, Mr. Braun. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn the court.
All rise. Hear me. Thank you.